Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I'm Ruth Jackson, and I want to welcome you to another unbelievable classic replay from our archives. Christian philosopher William Lane Craig and atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss met in Australia for three public dialogues on the existence of God back in 2013, which were pretty memorable for a variety of reasons. William Lane Craig and Lawrence Krauss joined Justin Briley to reflect on the value of the events and the way that it was carried out. We'll hear highlights of their discussion on whether God commanded genocide in the Old Testament, and if there is good evidence for the resurrection of Christ, and much, much more. So, on with today's classic replay.
Well, Lawrence, it's great to have you with me on the programme today. It was not long ago that you were sharing a stage on about three occasions with William Lane Craig in Australia for a series of dialogues. As we get into this, do you want to tell us about why you said yes to doing these events, what you see as the value of having these kind of dialogues about God and science?
Well, for me, the prime goal of doing all of these events is to give people a better perception of what science is all about and how remarkable the universe is. And so that's the fundamental reason. And the secondary reason is that is to combat what I think are misrepresentations that are propagated about science. So usually I like to be positive and talk about what we've learned about the universe and how fundamentally what is really important is that people need to have their beliefs conform to the evidence of reality rather than deciding the answers before they ask the questions. They should be willing to let the universe provide the answer. So part of my chief goal is to explain the utility of the scientific method, the power of the scientific method, and the remarkable natures, and try and get people excited about the remarkable nature of the universe. And to some extent, of course, I was able to do that in these debates. But the other thing that I try and do is counter misrepresentations, not only about science but about nature, by people who have vested interests. And in this case, I agreed to do these because, having had interactions with William Lane Craig before, it was clear to me that he misrepresents science completely in order to try and provide justification for beliefs he has that are just his beliefs. Yet he presents them as if with the authority of science, which he certainly demonstrated during these dialogues and in other cases certainly doesn't understand. And I felt it was really important to attack that credibility for people of goodwill who don't know, and they listen, and they think, well, when this man is quoting scientists or when he's quoting science, then he's doing it accurately. And as I tried to show, especially in the first discussion, there's very little accuracy there whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, you're obviously passionate. You got very animated during the discussion, especially the first one. You even had it came out later on a buzzer with you. Tell us about this buzzer. Yeah. What was the point of this buzzer?
Okay, well, in the first dialogue, I brought with me just in case. I was very, I've been very frustrated because these misrepresentations and sometimes outright lies about what people say or about the results of science have been repeated over and over again. And even when you point out that they're wrong or you point out that they're invalid, that happens again and again. And of course, I get very passionate about that kind of misrepresentation. In fact, I said at the very beginning of each dialogue that my chief goal was to discuss the aspects of science honestly, non-authoritarianism, open, full disclosure. And when those things are not presented, I tend to get upset. And one of the things I did was bring in that first Log Indeed a buzzer, which I don't think the audience can hear very much. But in a dialogue, certainly in a debate, you have very little chance when someone's talking for 10 minutes and then you have to talk to counter all of the erroneous facts that are made, especially if those facts are coming fast and furious, you might pick up one or two. And even in a dialogue, it was that case. So what at one point I bought the buzzer just to, I hit it each time there was an erroneous fact or claim about science, just so people, even though I wouldn't have time to counter each of them, so people could see that they were occurring, you know, several times a minute at some times, just so people could see that they, just a sort of a graphic representation of the fact that at least one scientist thought what was being said was complete nonsense.
Okay. I mean, it was a kind of a cheeky thing to do as well, wasn't it? I suppose.
Well,
I mean,
it was, you know, I guess what happened was part of it was also in response to the fact that we recently produced a movie, which hopefully will be aired around the world in the coming year. And which is really to provoke discussion and questioning. I was shocked when William Lane Craig did not just one or two, but three podcasts on the movies. I was shocked in particular because the movie hadn't been released. So I was wondering, it was at a film festival at one point. I was wondering, well, was it the film festival? And it wasn't. And I thought, well, either he got a pirated copy or he hasn't seen it. And then it was obvious that he hadn't seen it. And in fact, these three podcasts, which means, by the way, the fact that you're doing three podcasts means you're trying to jump on the bandwagon of Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins to try and raise your profile. And I get frustrated by that and annoyed by that.
So,
but then when you completely misrepresent and misstate what's being said in the documentary because you haven't seen it, that is downright cheesy, much more cheesy than having a buzzer, I think.
So you felt justified on that front. Well, that was atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss talking to me about how he felt his dialogues with William Lane Craig went in Australia. And in a moment, we'll hear some of the content of the first event. But I also spoke to William Lane Craig to get his take on how the events had gone. Bill, thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to, Justin. Thanks for the chance to be with you.
Should say at this point that I'm speaking to you completely separately to Krauss. This is not a dialogue on this show, but just wanted to get your response to some of the aspects of the debate, these clips that we're playing out today particularly. But first of all, what was your general impression of how the dialogue events went in the three cities you were in?
Well, I don't think they were really dialogues. They were intended to be conversations in which we would explore these questions together in a civil way. And unfortunately, I think that they really degenerated into a sort of barroom brawl where Krauss was constantly interrupting me, even literally shouting me down by raising his voice. It was very difficult to have any sort of an intelligent conversation with him. He would jump at points, he would dart off on rabbit trails. There was no sort of sustained, intelligent discussion in most of these dialogues. I would say only the third one in Melbourne did give us the opportunity for a substantive discussion of some of the issues.
Okay, so for you, limited helpfulness, but still large crowds, people obviously still interested in these issues.
Oh, yes, there were very large crowds, and these people paid money to get in, which sort of blew me away. These folks paid for tickets to attend these events because they had to rent the city hall in each case. And so it was really quite astonishing to see these crowds, and they were very largely secular crowds. I would say up to half may have been non-believers and quite partisan for Dr. Krauss.
Indeed. Tell us a bit about that first dialogue event, because he certainly came out guns blazing, particularly for you. A couple of the things that struck me were that he was quite interested in questioning your character, and so one of the issues he made something of was the Unbelievers movie and the fact that you'd done a podcast or two on it and misquoted at one point. You didn't have a chance to really respond to that in the debate, but I understand you've sort of clarified what happened afterwards.
Yes, I spoke to him privately afterwards, and I explained to him that we were working off an audio recording of the movie that was made by someone in the audience when the movie publicly premiered in Toronto, Canada. And so I couldn't actually see who was speaking. And so in one case, I thought it was Richard Dawkins speaking, but in fact it was the moderator. And so I misattributed these statements to Dawkins that were made by the moderator, and I told Krauss I regretted the mistake. We had actually been informed of this by a fellow in England just shortly after the podcasts went up, and we immediately took them down and corrected the mistake. But apparently Krauss had obtained a recording of the uncorrected podcast, which was up for a few days, and he played that and said it was deliberate distortion and misrepresentation, and I assured him it was an honest mistake, which I regretted, but not a case of deliberate misrepresentation and distortion. I wouldn't be that stupid to misattribute quotations in a movie that would be publicly distributed in movie theaters.
Another interesting aspect of the debate was it emerged that Krauss had a buzzer with him. What did you make of all that?
Well, I was just astonished, Justin, at his behavior in the Brisbane dialogue. It was very evident that Dr. Krauss was going for pure rhetorical appeals, and he had abandoned any sort of professionalism or debate etiquette in this event. Rather than addressing the topic, he attacked my character in the most vicious way, and then he raised all sorts of red herrings, like the question of the Canaanite slaughter in the Old Testament when we were talking supposedly about science and theology. And then during my opening speech, he was constantly making faces and histrionic gestures to the audience. And then, as you say, he even had an electronic buzzer, which he would press when he disagreed with something that I said in an attempt to disrupt my opening speech. It was just astonishing. In the 30 years of ministry that I've been in, I've never seen anyone behave in this manner before.
Well, certainly it was a colourful opening to these
yes,
events.
If anything,
I think probably by the end one that the tone had kind of settled down a little at least, and we will hear some of
By the time we got to Melbourne, the third dialogue, we were on a first name basis, and he told me after the Melbourne event, he said, "Bill," he said, "this may sound like faint praise, but," he said, "I do want to connote to you this note of faint praise, and that is my image of you has changed. I do not think that you are a liar and insincere. I think that you do sincerely believe what you're saying." In other words, he thinks I'm just deluded, but not a charlatan. So that was some small measure of progress that was made, I think.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, don't forget, you can email in your thoughts on today's programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can follow on Twitter at UnbelievableJB or on Facebook at facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, and today's show, as ever, online with full details of my guests and a way to find these videos of these recent dialogue events in Australia at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. On today's show, we're reviewing some recent dialogue events on the existence of God between leading atheist scientist Lawrence Krauss and leading Christian philosopher William Lane Craig. So let's hear some of the first event in Brisbane, and the title was "Has Science Buried God?" This is Lawrence Krauss. In his introductory speech, he particularly picked up on the issue of Old Testament warfare passages.
"This is the God we need to bury." In Deuteronomy, he said, "Kill all men and women." He told the Israelites, "Kill all the men and women in a conquered city. All the men in a conquered city, and seize the women, children, and livestock as plunder. But in the cities of these people, you should kill absolutely everybody." Now, we live in a world where you can't preach, in the modern world, in the non-fundamentalist world where you can't preach genocide anymore because we buried God. You can't, and if someone drowns their children in a bathtub because they say God is talking to them, we put them in a mental institution. Now, Dr. Craig loves children. But to go to the lengths of enforcing belief, this is what he says. To justify this. Why take the lives of innocent children? If we believe, as I do, that God's grace is extended to those who die in infancy or as small children, the death of these children was actually their salvation. Therefore, God does these children no wrong in taking their lives. It gets worse. He went on and said, who does God wrong in commanding the destruction of the Canaanites? Not the Canaanite adults, for they were corrupt and deserving of judgment. They deserve to die. Not the kids, because they inherit eternal life. Who are the really people that we should suffer for? The poor soldiers who had to kill them. If that isn't obscene enough, Dr. Craig then, a third time, went back and thought about this and said, you know what, I've come to appreciate as a result of a closer reading of the biblical text that God's command to Israel was not primarily to exterminate the Canaanites, but to drive them out of the land. If they just left, no one had been killed at all. Only those who remained were to be utterly exterminated. Oh, that's great. That obscenity is the reason that my friend and colleague Richard Dawkins will not appear on stage with this man.
Well, that was Lawrence Krauss in his opening speech. Later on in the moderated discussion, Bill had a chance to explain his view on the Old Testament passages.
Who has the right to determine whether someone should live or die? You'd say it's God. You'd say God said the Canaanites should die. I mean, I'm going back to it because I find what you said so morally reprehensible that it sickens me.
Well, you have to look at the historical context. Now, you folks who are applauding on that, I wonder, have you read the narratives? Have you read the historical context of what that's about?
I read what you said. Do you disagree with anything you said?
Yes, but you have to look at the historical context. I said a lot more than that. What I pointed out
was... The children are okay to be killed because they're going to have eternal salvation.
No.
That's
a misrepresentation of what I said, Dr.
Well, you want to go back and repeat and read it?
I would like to explain it.
Okay.
What I said there is that God pronounced judgment upon these nation states that were inhabiting Canaan. He had waited 400 years to bring judgment upon them. By the time he did so, these cultures were incredibly evil, incredibly reprobate. And God brought judgment upon them by destroying them as nation states. That is to say, the command to the Israeli armies was to drive these Canaanite tribes out of the land. They were being divested of the land. That's what's important to these Middle Eastern peoples, and still is today. It's the land.
Absolutely. And you would say, in fact, Osama bin Laden would say, the United States and Australia are morally reprehensible, and we have to destroy them. What's wrong with him saying that?
Because...
We live in a world where we realize those kind of divine proclamations are nonsense and irrational.
But it's not. See, I've given a moral theory that you didn't explain that explains how this is consistent with an all-loving, all-just God.
All-loving?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He didn't love the Canaanites.
And the point is that God brought judgment upon those adults by destroying these nation states and driving them out of the land and giving the land to Israel. Now, the difficult part of this is the command that those who remain behind to fight and to resist, to refuse to flee, were to be exterminating, even the children.
Yeah.
And my point there is that God, as the author and giver of life, has the right to take and give life as he sees fit. He is not obligated to prolong my existence
for
1 second.
Who determines what God has decided?
No, wait, let me finish. God has the right to give and take life as he sees fit. In fact, all of us will die someday, and some children die in infancy earlier than others. God had the right to take the lives of those children if he so willed.
But God didn't. The Israelites did.
Right. That's a very good point. He used Israel as an instrument.
How do you know?
Pardon me?
How do you know he used Israel? How do you know they weren't just an imperialistic power who wanted to have the land because it was better for growing things?
But if you say that, then there's no objection to divine command morality. The whole point here is that you're saying there's some sort of inconsistency in affirming that God is all just and all loving, and yet he issued these commands. If you don't think he issued the commands, if you think these are just legends or fables, then there's no problem. The whole problem only arises... if you think that God
exists. There was a problem for the Canaanites.
I haven't got to my critical point yet, though.
Okay.
And that is, God has the right to give and take life as he sees fit. He can take a child's life now if he wants, rather than letting that child live longer. What he did in this case was he took the lives of these children via the instrument of his judgment, namely Israel. Now, the question is, did he wrong those children in doing that? That's the issue. Did he do something wrong to those children in some way? And my point is, no, he did not, because those children went to an eternity of incomprehensible joy and eternal life in the presence of a loving God.
Well, that was Lawrence Krauss and William Lane Craig, and we're hearing today on the programme some extracts from their recent dialogue events in Australia. I've spoken to both of them separately to reflect on this particular part of the discussion on this issue of the Old Testament passages around Canaanites and so on. I began by asking Krauss why he chose to focus on this issue. Some people said after the debate you were more interested in kind of attacking Bill Craig's character than addressing the question of has science buried God?
In attacking his character. I was interested in attacking his ideas and his misrepresentations. Now, that wasn't a misrepresentation. That was an idea, and I do think it's morally reprehensible, and it's worth attacking. I think I told you the main reason I agreed to do those debates is to counter misrepresentations of facts or science or the key misrepresentation that somehow religion has hijacked morality, that somehow religion, that science is this statement that's too often made, that science is about, you know, how and religion is why, and science isn't, you know, can't address moral issues, but religion does. And my that is also not only a misrepresentation of science, but in my opinion, as he eminently represented in that discussion, the claim that science, that religion is a moral force is in many cases ludicrous, and especially since each religion has their own God and their own morality, and they're not consistent. You have to, as he said during the debate, all the other religions are wrong and he's right. Well, how can anyone deal with that kind of an argument? Which is a problem of religious in general, that they claim that your view is divinely right and the others are wrong. And as I said in the discussion, everyone is an atheist about all the other religions.
Sure. I mean, obviously, if you kind of take Bill's perspective, okay, he believes in the God of the Bible. He takes it from a Christian worldview. What do you make of his claim within that worldview that, well, if God is the author of life, then he has the authority to give and take it? Do you feel that's an adequate justification for these kinds of stories in the Old Testament?
No. I mean, because the claim is that you know, it's more, you see, what you're saying is, well, that statement, if God creates life, then God has the right to take it or not. Well, that may be a logically true statement, but it's beyond that. You're claiming that these statements are, that you are understanding that this is God's claim. And therefore, you're claiming that you have special insight into God, and that you can interpret these results because you believe. So ultimately, you believe that God is just and right, and anything that happens, therefore, you will justify in terms of that belief, because you can't see another possibility. I would argue that, in fact, when you see that kind of literature and that kind of story, it's much more likely for a reasonable person to say, this clearly could not represent what is claimed to be a just and reasonable God, and therefore, in fact, it's very irrational to believe in that. It's much more likely that these are stories based on historical wars that went on, and that people justify their actions after the fact by the claim that God is on their side. It's almost always a justification in war, and so as I say, someone like him, who's an apologist, says, look, I'll take this. Obviously, and I think many people, if they were looking at it objectively, would say morally reprehensible action or set of actions. And I'll find justification for it. Instead of asking the possibility, could it be that this was wrong? You see, that's the point. Because it's in the scriptures, you can't even ask the question, could it be that this was an immoral act?
I mean, the way
that you make the assumption it can't be immoral because it's God. And the Old Testament is just full of disgusting behavior. And the claim that the God that if it's true that disgusting behavior represents a God, then the God that represents is relatively disgusting. Yeah. That's the point I want to make.
Atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss speaking to me there about the first of the dialogues with Christian philosopher William Lane Craig. This issue of the Canaanite passages in the Old Testament, well, for balance, we'll hear the other side of the story in a moment's time. William Lane Craig with his reflection on this particular aspect of their dialogue on these Canaanite passages and so on. That's in a short moment's time after a quick break. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. I remember when you came to the UK 2 years ago, and this really is what happened then. A number of atheists picked up on a blog you'd written about sort of looking at a rationale for the Canaanite passages in the Old Testament and so on. And that was used back then by Richard Dawkins as a reason for why he refused to debate you here in the UK.
Yes.
Obviously, 2 years on, it's still being drawn upon. For you, though, as you said before, you feel that this was a bit of a red herring being used by Krauss in this debate.
Well, it certainly was. This was purely for rhetorical purposes because the topic was supposed to be, has science buried God? Is science in some way incompatible with the existence of God? So this was purely a red herring to win emotional points and get the audience on his side. But I felt that as long as he was going to bring it up, there was no point in ducking the issue. I would address it directly and explain my moral theory and defend my position. And in the course of the dialogue that you just played, what hit me very forcefully was that Dr. Krauss doesn't even understand the objection, much less...
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
The solution. He's just venting emotionally about this question. But he doesn't understand that the objection is there's supposed to be some kind of inconsistency here between God's being all good and all loving and his issuing this command. And if you listen to the remainder of the dialogue, he actually comes to admit that I do solve that problem, that my theory shows that there is no such inconsistency. And that is a huge concession because it means that the objection evaporates. What he, in the end, says is that it's not significant to show that something is consistent. You have to show that it's true. But, of course, that just shows he doesn't understand the objection. As I said, if these narratives aren't true, then there is no problem. There's no difficulty then because God never issued such commands. So the whole problem is a consistency problem. Does the biblical theist affirm two inconsistent propositions, namely that God is all good and all loving, and yet he issued these commands? And Krauss comes to admit in the course of this dialogue that I do solve that problem.
And one of the things that Krauss was keen to push was that whereas scientists are willing to abandon theories and let the evidence take them where they will. You've already decided your outcome. You've got a God. And therefore, when it comes to problems like the stories of the Canaanites in the Old Testament, you have to sort of duck and dive and make your theory fit, essentially. And that therefore, the way you use evidence isn't appropriate. And you're not sort of doing things in the way that the scientific sort of approach should be done.
And that's just simply false. As I pointed out in the dialogue, it is simply false, and he knows this is false, that scientists, when they confront an inconsistency or recalcitrant data, just abandon their theory. They don't. They try to adjust the theory. They try to adjust auxiliary hypotheses to try to bring consistency into the theory. They do not simply abandon their theory when it confronts recalcitrant data. And the theologian does exactly the same thing. And if the inconsistency cannot be resolved, then the theologian will give up the historicity of these narratives, for example. He will come to regard them as either legends, or perhaps he will see them as incidents that actually happened, but Israel mistakenly thought that God had issued such commands. So there is no difference here between the theologian and the scientist when you are confronted with an inconsistency between your theory and the data.
Do you think this in any way will have put this to bed, or do you expect this to come around every time you're invited to?
You know why it won't be put to bed, Justin, is because it's not a substantive issue. It's a rhetorical ploy. It had nothing to do with the topic that night, but it was rhetorically effective in moving the audience emotionally to the side of the skeptic or secularist. And that's why it will continue to be employed. Krauss admitted that I solved the intellectual problem. I was able to show there's no inconsistency between God's being all good and all loving and his issuing this command. But that's not why the objection is deployed by the atheists. It's deployed for rhetorical purposes, and so we can expect to continue to hear it brought up.
And you could hear in the clip there that there were obviously applause from the atheists in the in the audience.
This was red meat to the Krauss fans in the audience. He's very popular in Australia, and Australia is a very secular society. So they were out in huge numbers, and they were there to cheer. And as you heard, they certainly did so.
But I was interested also to hear that there was a round of applause when you sort of made a firm point in the other opposite direction.
Yes, that's true. Fair enough. That's right.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today we've been reflecting on a number of dialogue events that took place in Australia recently between leading Christian thinker William Lane Craig and outspoken atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss. Well, let's go and hear another part of their discussion. In the third debate in Melbourne, the title was Is It Reasonable to Believe in God? And we'll start by hearing part of William Lane Craig's case for the existence of God.
God is the best explanation of the historical facts concerning the resurrection of Jesus. Most people think that Jesus' resurrection is something you just believe in by faith or not. But actually, there are three facts recognized by the majority of New Testament historians today, which I believe are best explained by the hypothesis of Jesus' resurrection. Namely, the discovery of his empty tomb on the Sunday morning following his crucifixion. Two, the appearances of Jesus alive after his death to various individuals and groups, and three, his disciples suddenly and sincerely coming to believe that God raised him from the dead. And I'll be happy to discuss in detail any of these during our dialogue. Attempts to explain away these three great facts, like the disciples stole the body, or Jesus wasn't really dead, have been universally rejected by contemporary scholarship. The simple fact is that there just is no plausible, naturalistic explanation of these three facts. And therefore, it seems to me, the Christian is amply justified in believing that the best explanation of the evidence is that Jesus rose from the dead and therefore was who he claimed to be. But that entails that the God who raised Jesus from the dead exists. And thus we have a good inductive argument for the existence of God based on the resurrection of Jesus.
That was William Lane Craig. During his opening speech, Lawrence Krauss gave his verdict on the resurrection.
Now, the only thing, as Dr. Craig has pointed out, that seems to have gotten any currency is the resurrection. That's the one thing, and I was just talking to a member of the City Bible Forum who was happy enough to drive me to the airport in Sydney, and he said it was the resurrection that convinced him. And I think for Dr. Craig, it's probably the resurrection. We've already discussed this before. But, you know, the point is, many of my colleagues, when I write a paper, they say, it's wrong, your paper's wrong, and I did it first. And I think that's the point. There's nothing new about a resurrection. It's as old as every god and every creation myth. There's lots of examples. Dionysus and Jesus are so close to being identical. They both were born from a virgin mother. They both had a divine father. They both were resurrected. They both transformed wine into water, etc., etc., etc. Osiris, the Egyptian god of life, death, in fact, the New Kingdom, this is almost 2,000 years before Christ, in principle, the idea was that people would be resurrected with Osiris if they followed the correct religious rituals. But the point about the resurrection is that there's no evidence of it. There's no evidence it would pass muster in a science lab, much less a court of law. It's hearsay, stories written based on oral traditions decades or hundreds of years after the fact, which are inconsistent with each other. There's nothing. When Dr. Craig tells me, and I said it before, historians of the Bible, theologians and people, scholars of the Bible, all accept that the resurrection happened. It reminds me of when I debate alien abduction experts who say, all alien abduction experts say people were abducted by aliens. Well, that doesn't mean much to me. Given that it's never been observationally verified, is it reasonable to expect that someone comes back from the dead? It's never been observed, never been seen. So is it reasonable to expect that it happened once when no one could see it and when no one actually reported on it at the time? No. In fact, the fact that people may have seen Jesus walking, if they did, if they report that, I'm willing to accept their belief that they did. But as Oliver Sacks has described it beautifully in a recent book, hallucinations are real to those people that experience them.
A clip there of Lawrence Krauss at the third Melbourne debate with his case against the resurrection. Well, he and William Lane Craig sat down for a moderated discussion. Graham Oppie was the moderator, and here's part of their conversation that concerned the resurrection.
Do you want to say something
well,
about this?
Well, what I wanted to say, Lawrence, is that your comparisons of Jesus of Nazareth with Dionysus and Osiris is based upon scholarship that is more than 100 years out of date. And I think that, I think you've been fed a lot of misinformation by skeptics and internet infidel types that are really misleading you on where historical Jesus scholarship has stayed. Let me explain two things about this, why this view is mm-hmm. gone now. It's over 100 years out of date. Scholars in comparative religion and in the history of religions, during the late 19th century, ransacked the literature of ancient mythology looking for these kind of parallels mm-hmm. to Jesus, and some tried to explain the origins of Christianity from mm-hmm. these. That movement soon collapsed, however, primarily for two reasons. First of all, the parallels turned out to be spurious. When you look at these supposed parallels between Dionysus and Jesus, or Osiris and Jesus, they just don't hold up. Dionysus was not raised from the dead. Osiris, in the myths, lives on in the underworld. The pieces of his body were scattered and reassembled by his wife. He doesn't rise from the dead. So, in fact, there is nothing in the ancient world comparable to belief in the resurrection of Jesus in these myths. What scholars have discovered over the last half century or so is what's been called the Jewish reclamation of Jesus. That is the re-realization that Jesus was a Jew, surprise, and it's against the backdrop of Judaism that he must be understood. That the proper interpretive context for Jesus of Nazareth is not pagan mythology, but first century Palestinian Judaism. And when interpreted against that backdrop, the Gospels emerge as very credible historical sources. The second the second thing to be said about this myth theory is that there's no causal connection between these myths and these earliest disciples. These kinds of cults and of dying and rising gods weren't even present in first century Palestine, and it would be unthinkable that these original disciples of Jesus would have come to believe he was risen from the dead because somebody had said something about Osiris.
Look, okay, I don't want to try and claim I'm an expert in theology or biblical history. So one may argue that the connections are spurious, and I'm willing to accept that fact, okay? But that still doesn't obviate a few things, that there are many different historical... there's a number one bestseller, as you know, in the New York Times bestseller list by someone who says, you know, Jesus was a revolutionary, his followers trying to deify him. It seems like an interesting and credible argument. I'm not an expert, but I know a lot of people are saying, first of all, it's nothing new about that argument.
No.
And the author agrees it's nothing new, but it's an interesting argument. But the main point is, big deal. If someone tells me they saw someone rise from the dead, I have to ask, how likely is it? How likely is it that they're hallucinating? Or how likely is it? I'm skeptical of everyone. So if I want to create a movement, how much more likely is it for me to claim that the head of my movement is divine and rose from the dead? Well, there's a lot of motivation for that. So I'm very skeptical until someone provides me more evidence than hearsay, and often contradictory hearsay or stories written many, many years after the fact.
Well, those are all good points to raise, and they are discussed in my published work on this subject. I did my doctoral work in Munich on the resurrection. And I think that the hallucination theory, for example, has numerous problems that make it less preferable as an explanation. And as for probability considerations, this is this appeal that you made to David Hume again earlier. And I think Hume's argument is simply demonstrably fallacious. He didn't understand the probability calculus. It hadn't been developed in his day.
As did Leibniz, by the way. But anyway, okay.
And so when Hume says that no amount of evidence can serve to establish a miracle.
No, he said the evidence, it has to be such that the evidence that falsifies it is more remarkable than the evidence that supports it.
Yes.
That seems to be a very rational argument. And you can argue that people have disputed, but I haven't heard a rational argument why that statement is wrong. It's really the same statement Sagan made. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If you're going to say that someone rose from the dead, if you're going to say that someone levitated, then you better have... Then the claim that it has to be more remarkable to argue that they didn't than they did and I think
you're,
that's a perfectly reasonable...
You're quoting what's called Hume's maxim, and that is the germ of truth that some philosophers try to retrieve from Hume's fallacious argument. But all that amounts to saying is, which is more probable, that God raised Jesus from the dead or one of these other alternative theories like hallucination, apparent death, conspiracy theory? Let's take...
There you go, a few clips from one of the dialogue events between William Lane Craig and Lawrence Krauss that took place in Australia. All three are now available, as I said earlier, at citybibleforum.org to watch. Well, I've been recording separately with Lawrence Krauss and William Lane Craig to get their reflections on the debate. So let's begin looking at the resurrection with Lawrence Krauss, and I began by asking him about his particular view of Jesus. You did at least concede that the evidence probably suggests there was a Jesus of some kind, Lawrence. But you're...
Well, at some point I said, if the historical arguments are this, it's more likely than not. But I wouldn't say, would I say it's absolutely certain? No.
Sure. But when it comes to the resurrection, I mean, you're up front, you know, you're not a biblical historian or anything like that. But for you as a scientist...
Yeah, and again, that was, it's taken out of context, of course, but I really did want to make the statement that it's really important that I'm not willing to debate the fine points of theology. Well, I'm not claiming to be an expert in biblical history. And what frustrates me is when people who are equally or, in fact, more ignorant about the science claim that they have mastered the science completely. So go on.
So and that's the way you obviously feel Billy is kind of sticking his nose into an area that he doesn't...
He distorts science as much more than... as much as anyone that talks about these things, but with giving the perception that in fact he actually understands it.
Yeah. As a scientist,
and demonstrating over and over again in the discussions we have that he doesn't have the slightest idea what science is all about. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, go. I mean, as a scientist and as an atheist, is the problem here that for you, a naturalistic explanation of this event, these facts that Bill presented in his
own... Let's jump in. There are facts and there are stories. And there's a huge difference. So I don't know which facts you're talking about. If you're certainly not calling the resurrection a fact. If you
you're
making a claim that's not appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, what he's saying is that the facts of, for instance, the discovery of the empty tomb, which is sort of...
Hold on, that's not a fact. That's a story that's in a book, not written by even the people who claimed to discover the empty tomb, but people who talked to those people. So, and written at least 5 years, and in some cases 30 years after the fact. So one of the things that's really important, and I tried to demonstrate in these discussions, is when people say, Jesus said this, well, Jesus didn't say that. Someone wrote that someone said that, and in this particular case, there's no fact that there was an empty tomb. There's a fact that there was a claim by someone who wrote a story that some other women who are not the authors of the argument claim to have discovered an empty tomb. So let's not jump to the conclusion that this third-hand hearsay done maybe decades after the fact is a fact. Certainly, as I said in my discussion, it would never hold weight in court.
Well, indeed. I mean, what it is, boils down to is the question of what can we count as historical evidence for things. And I think the majority of New Testament historians believe that the fact that an empty tomb is recorded as having been discovered across the different accounts that we have is corroborated.
They're not different. They're cross-correlated. They're based on oral traditions. I think it's kind of an incredibly low standard of proof. It's like the standard of proof, which I also made fun of, that that Pope John Paul is responsible for miracles. I mean, if you just look at the likelihood that, you know, that the coincidences that could happen, it's just saying, oh, this matches what we'd like. Let's accept the standard proof. We've got a bunch of stories based on oral traditions that are not independent in any way that converge, although there are contradictory facts about dates and other things, which would be characteristic of oral traditions. And so you're telling me that I think it's an incredibly shoddy standard and would not in any other context be classified as historical fact. I don't think historians in general would accept a few oral traditions of something remarkable.
Is that whole question. I mean, in the end, historical studies is an area where you have to kind of look at ancient documents and decide what is sort of valid, what likely did happen, separate, you know, myths from what seems to be corroborated as something that did actually occur. I mean, leaving that aside...
I mean, I think people, you know, would not read the Iliad and suggest, for example, that the events in the Iliad or, you know, all of those fantastical things actually happened because someone wrote it down.
Well, I mean, I guess the point is that with all our historical records, we have records that don't go up right up to the time that, you know, we always are getting secondhand accounts a little bit further down the line. And the Bible is just the same as all others in that. In fact, it's closer to the events than many other.
No, I don't think it's the same. I think the Bible is the Bible is based on a... One should be skeptical of the purpose of a document, just like one should be skeptical when someone's selling you something. What are they getting out of it? The Bible is designed to show, in the New Testament, that this man was divine.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there's a purpose behind it. It's not some objective bit of evidence, document saying, well, one day I discovered this, one day I discovered that, and you decide for yourself, or here's a historical thing. It's a document that's designed, the main purpose, by disciples to argue that the person that they believed as their leader was divine. So immediately, as a historian or as a scientist, I'm saying, okay, well, they have a vested interest in that. And so is it a historical document like the others? Absolutely not. Moreover, it better not be a historical document because the Bible is so full of scientific nonsense that we all know it can't be an accurate representation of what happened. The earth didn't stand, the sun didn't stand still in the sky, Adam and Eve didn't exist, etc., etc. And certainly the Bible's discussion of the creation of the world has got all the things in the wrong order. So we have to realize that it's a document, it's a literary document, not a historical one or a scientific one.
Is there any kind of evidence from history that could ever persuade you that a miracle occurred at some point?
Evidence from history? No. No, absolutely not. Because, I mean, as I said, I know of cases where many people have seen flying saucers and really believe they've seen flying saucers. As Richard Feynman said, he thought it's due to the much more likely due to the known irrationality of human beings than the unknown irrationality of aliens.
And does
so what would convince me would be, as I said, I think in that discussion, is one bit of evidence. Don't you find it slightly unusual that these miracles all occurred in a time when there's no independent way of checking them? You know, there's no video recording. You know, if God really wanted to do a miracle that anyone would believe in, why not do it in a time when you can actually put it on YouTube? If I were to look, as I said that night, if I were to look up in the sky and this tonight, and it's clear where I am in Washington State, if I were to look up tonight and see the stars and they realigned and they said in Aramaic or Hebrew or as I said, I think I said that night in English because in my country a lot of people think God speaks only English, and they said, I am here, then boy, I'd say, you know, there's something worth thinking about here.
Yeah.
It's not history that's going to come in, because miracles mean that the laws of nature have been suspended.
Mm.
And so since we've never seen that in our time in science, in modern science, we have to say that for that to really be likely to have happened, I need a bit of evidence, not the claims of people, because people claim to have seen fairies, people claim to see lots of things. So humans' claims about seeing, you know, lots of weird things are certainly not enough to convince anyone, in my opinion, any rationally skeptical person that something like that happened.
Well, I want to say thank you for coming on and sharing your reflections on just a couple of the aspects of that debate.
I must admit, I hesitated to do them, I don't want to make more of them than they are, because I don't want to promote what this fallacious nonsense and talking about it in some sense promotes it. But anyway, I'm glad we got this.
yeah, absolutely. There was a second debate that hasn't been put down on video yet, but
these aren't debates, they were discussions. There were actually four discussions.
Okay, yeah.
There were three between me and William McCree, and one between me and another young Christian would-be apologist in Perth.
Okay. Well, perhaps...
And there's a second one. And by the way, only one of them was videotaped for distribution. The others were done archivally. But then it turned out that the quality was sufficient, and especially the third one was so complimentary to the first that when the group asked if they could, even though it had been done for just archival purposes, if it would be reasonable to put on the web, I thought, that's not a bad idea, because there are enough complimentary points to the first discussion that was worth it. The second one really doesn't have much extra in it, but there were sound quality problems, but I understand that it's been, I heard that it was remastered, and I think it was, and I said, well, you know, there's so much interest, can we put it online? Okay. I said, sure.
Okay. So we might see the second one at some point. But the
certainly soon, I expect, to get it ready.
Great, great stuff. Well, in the last part of the show, we heard Lawrence Krauss with a number of criticisms of the arguments for the resurrection. So I spoke to William Lane Craig once again to get the other side of the story, his thoughts on the argument that he presented for the resurrection in Australia and how Krauss responded to it. A very common phrase that's often comes up in this is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. What point were you trying to get to at the end there when you were saying that's really not the case?
Before I address that, Justin, I just want to flag the very significant shift of ground and concession made by Professor Krauss in the course of this dialogue. He has consistently, prior to this, claimed that Jesus is a mythological figure who probably never existed and is based upon these Greco-Roman pagan myths like Dionysus. And here he concedes that that is not correct. So this is a very significant concession on his part, giving up the idea that the resurrection of Jesus is just mythological. Instead now, he's reduced to either the conspiracy theory, which nobody holds to today, or to some sort of hallucination theory, which would then need to be defended. So that's a very significant shift of ground. Now, with respect to the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, that's simply a popular slogan expressing David Hume's argument against the identification of a miracle. And it is, as I say, demonstrably, mathematically false. It is simply false that highly improbable events require an extraordinary amount of evidence in order to establish. What probability theorists came to realize is that you need to consider not only the credibility of the witnesses, but you also need to consider how probable would it be that we would have this evidence that we do if the event had not taken place. That is to say, if there were no resurrection, how probable is it that we would have things like the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection? And I would say that is extraordinarily improbable that we would have those kinds of events, that kind of evidence, if there had been nothing that happened, if there were no resurrection. And that can easily outbalance any intrinsic improbability that one might see in the resurrection itself. So when you understand the full probability that is involved, Hume's argument is simply fallacious. And that maxim that Dr. Krauss quotes, it's called Hume's maxim. If you listen to the debate I had with Peter Millikan in Birmingham on my UK trip 2 years ago, Millikan, who is a Hume scholar, himself says that that maxim is either true but trivial, or else it's significant but false. So take your pick, pick your poison. It's either true but trivial, or it's significant, but in that case, it's false.
Well, one of the things that I think Krauss believes is that simply when it comes to these kinds of events, you just don't have evidence in the way that you have evidence for things in science, say. And so when you say the empty tomb is a fact of history, he'll say, no, it's not a fact. It's a second-hand report, you know, delivered maybe 30 years later. And why on earth should we make a deduction from that kind of evidence? What would be your response to that?
Well, he's not consistent here, Justin. I mean, on the one hand, he seems to grant the facts, but then try to explain them away by conspiracy or hallucination. On the other hand, then, as you say, he will say, well, why should we believe these facts? They are based upon testimonial evidence. And with respect to that second point, of course historians are aware of the challenges of establishing events in ancient history. And what I would argue is that when you apply the same historiographical tools to these events of the life of Jesus, we have very good grounds for thinking that the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection are indeed historical facts. They pass the common test for historicity, like multiple independent early attestation in the sources, dissimilarity, embarrassment, very similitude to the historical context in which they were written, and so on and so forth. And that's why the majority of historians who have studied the fate of Jesus of Nazareth concur on those three facts. These are not the opinions of just conservative or Christian scholars. These represent the conclusions of the broad mainstream of historical scholarship concerning Jesus of Nazareth, both Christian and non-Christian.
I mean, another issue that's brought up, and I think Krauss is also concerned about here, is that, well, these are biased accounts. You know, if you, of course, yes. they had a very good reason for claiming their Messiah had risen. They wanted to convince the people reading these accounts that Jesus was unique and special. So, how would you counter that, Bill?
Well, two things. All ancient history is biased. Every ancient historian writes from a perspective. So that's not unique to the Gospels. And, of course, modern-day historians are aware of this, and so they will apply objective criteria to try to see if the facts in the narratives are simply a reflection of the writer's own biases and prejudices, or whether or not these have some credible claim to being rooted in history. And as I say, when you apply those tests to the gospel, then these three facts emerge. So, again, I think Dr. Krauss is just speaking out of ignorance here. He hasn't read the historical scholarship on the Gospels, and realize that critics are aware of the problem of bias, and they correct for it.
I suspect, though, in the end, it's going to be difficult to ever persuade someone like Professor Krauss of a miracle. His, you know, when asked, I think during the debate, well, what would you accept as evidence for God? He said, well, if the stars rearrange themselves to say, here I am.
Yeah. Did you notice that, Justin? He said, if there were even a shred of empirical evidence. And then he says, like the stars rearranging themselves and saying, I am here. Well, that's not what I would call a shred of empirical evidence. We certainly have more than a shred of empirical evidence for the facts of the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances, and the origin of the Christian faith. And that's why the majority of historians who have studied this are convinced of those. And nobody would defend things like the conspiracy theory today. Very few would defend the hallucination theory. So I think Dr. Krauss is just speaking from ignorance here, quite honestly. And ironically, in the case of the stars rearranging themselves, as I pointed out in the dialogue, the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life is actually far, far more improbable than seeing I am here written in the stars. So why doesn't he believe the evidence of the fine-tuning? I think that this just reflects a kind of emotional prejudice on his part. As I said, I don't think you're really open to the evidence.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for being on the line with me to give your reflections.
My pleasure.
Overall, do you still think you'll continue to kind of pursue these sorts of dialogue-type events? Do you feel they are, on the whole, valuable?
I think they're very valuable. I think that it becomes very evident in the course of these debates who has the substantive arguments and who is just going for rhetorical impact. I do not think I would participate in a dialogue format with someone like Lawrence Krauss, however, because he's incapable of carrying on a civil conversation. When you look at the number of interruptions in these dialogues, if you count them, I interrupted Krauss, I think, 9 times in the course of the Melbourne event. He interrupted me 72 times, and it was similar in the other events. And so for someone like him, I think you need to have a debate format where you have structured speeches with time limits rather than a dialogue format, because he simply doesn't have the ability to carry on a civil conversation and therefore uses the dialogue format to run over his opponent and to abuse the time.
Well, thank you very much for giving your time on the program today, Bill. Great to catch up with you, and all the best as you continue in your ministry at Reasonable Faith.
Thank you, Justin. Good to be with you.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree there was a lot going on there. What did you think? Do you think Krauss was justified in his use of the buzzer? Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.